We are very fortunate today to have Eleanor Ocampo deliver the comments. Eleanor is professor of history at University of Southern California, where she has also served as vice dean, acting chair of history, and of the program for the study of women and men in society. She's the author of numerous monographs, two edited volumes, and a well-received textbook. I want to call your attention especially to her most recent monograph on Nellie Roussel, titled Blessed Motherhood, Bitter Fruit, Nellie Roussel and the Politics of Female Pain in Third Republic France. She has co-edited a book entitled Confronting Modernity in Fin de Siècle France, and co-authored another book on gender and the politics of social reform. She has received numerous awards from USC, as well as an ACLS and NEH fellowships. Eleanor is currently working on a study of the responses to the 1918 influenza epidemic in France, the UK, and the US, with an emphasis on its interaction with World War I, press censorship, and the repression of memory. Her working title for this book is The Silent Killer of World War I, The Great Influenza Epidemic of 1918 and the Repression of Its Memory. She has already published a book chapter on this and has lectured on this in the UK and in the US from coast to coast and in between. We now welcome Eleanor's comments.
Thank you, Rachel, for that introduction. And I'd like to also thank the panelists, and especially Jean Pedersen, for the privilege of commenting on these three very interesting papers. As noted by the title of this session, the one thematic thread that binds them together is the Dreyfus Affair. Yet rather than addressing the elements of the affair itself, Eric's paper focuses on philosophical currents within which the affair unfolded, and Jean's and Liz's papers look at the moral responses and how those responses were communicated. By not placing the affair itself at the center of their respective queries, these papers permit us to consider it as a symptom of the fin de siècle political and psychological malaise, rather than as a cause of the malaise and political turmoil. Each of these papers, in some manner, describes an effort to reestablish morality in a world that had lost its moral compass. Let me begin with Eric's paper, for I think his depiction of the philosophical issues of the era effectively sets a tone for the Dreyfus Affair itself, as well as a context for the subjects of Jean's and Liz's papers. His paper opens with a philosophical dispute between Baptiste Jacob and Henri Bergson, and the challenge that the new science of psychology posed to philosophy. According to Jacob, Bergson's philosophy challenged the concept of reality itself, questioned the objectivity of truth, and therefore of the possibility of rationalism or even of a common intellectual life. While Jacob's embodied rationalism offered a means to move out of the historical moment of 1897, Bergson, with his intuition and mysticism, was more of the historical moment. While Jacob believed that the Republic embodied the philosophical truths of rationalism, Bergsonian philosophy was implicitly anti-Republican and could be used to support anti-Republican projects. Yet it was Bergson who was the popular philosophical mode of the day, and Jacob who was out of fashion. I do have one question for Eric, and that is how the embodiment of rationalism gets played out, a philosophical rationalism gets played out with regard to the Dreyfus Affair. But rather than engaging in the philosophical debate itself, of which I am ill-equipped, as a social and cultural historian, I would rather consider Bergson's philosophy and Jacob's reaction to it as symptomatic reflections of their time. Bergsonian intuition tapped into the collective psyche of the 1890s. It helps explain the apparent irrationality of the anti-Dreyfusards in the face of rational empirical evidence, such as Esterhazy's admission in July 1898 that he had written the infamous bordereau himself. Such a fact did not prevent Dreyfus from being reconvicted the following September, nor did it prevent diehard anti-Dreyfusards from believing in his guilt for the rest of their lives. Did they willfully ignore all empirical evidence, such as that printed in Jean Jaurès's Les Preuves? The apparent blindness to empirical evidence suggests a pervasive predisposition among a large portion of the French, indeed of the European population, particularly with its obsession of degeneration, a predisposition to be moved by intuition and emotion rather than by reason. This fin de siècle tendency also explains Bergson's popular appeal. As Eric concludes, the philosophical conflicts he describes here pre-exist the Dreyfus affair, and, quoting him, are perhaps evidence against the more recent tendency to emphasize the apparent contingency of Dreyfusard affinities, unquote. His examination of the Jacob-Bergson conflict here is convincing of that point. Other social scientists of the era also emphasized a collective psychology that no doubt contributed to the Dreyfus affair. The enormously influential Gustave Le Bon also challenged rationalism and provided fuel for anti-republican projects in his famous work, 1895 work, The Mind of Crowds. Here he claimed that that modern psychology established the truth that unconscious phenomena play a preponderating part in the operations of intelligence. No series of events demonstrated that more than the Dreyfus affair. Georges Platon, who, as Eric notes, chastised Baptiste Jacob for seeing the world as a classroom and for being a weak tamer of the female sex in his effort to teach rational morality, would have abhorred the efforts of Paul Desjardins and his maxims, as well as Emma Rus' distribution of them. If Eric's paper suggests a collective psyche that has lost its ballast, Jean's offers an example of efforts to establish a morally rational basis for resurrecting one. She brings our attention to the remarkable efforts on Wuss' part to distribute not only the maxims for the crisis of the Dreyfus affair, but French actions that favored patriotism over chauvinism, openness to foreigners, and demonstrated values such as honesty, sincerity, freedom, and enfranchisement and independence. Wuss, in other words, not only valiantly distributed through an impressive network of teachers a type of moral education, she was doing the same thing as Baptiste Jacob in pushing for the truth of fact based on solid evidence from which an equitable truth, not an intuitive truth, would naturally follow. Jean seeks to place Wuss in the network of intellectuals to which Paul Desjardins belonged, but in the end begins to question whether in fact she was an intellectual, which of course depends on how one defines intellectual. Was she a creator of ideas? Jean's paper suggests that she was a disseminator of ideas rather than a creator of them, and in that action we find her real contribution. Like Baptiste Jacob, she equated the Republic with rational thought and rational thought with French identity. I'm curious to know how Wuss' efforts resonated with her targeted audience of parents, teachers, and children of both sexes, particularly given that they lived in German-occupied Alsace, where French national identity must have been more difficult to foster. What were some of the specific French actions readers of Pour nos enfants sent in response to her solicitations? Desjardins' work may have been more lucrative in the Paris region, but it seems ultimately Wuss' work had more practical implications. Liz's paper addresses the process of networking, indeed what we would today call crowdsourcing, with the Henri subscription. Her innovative contribution here is to study the evolution of the subscription over time and to show how it served as a social medium, a site of sociability, and a locus of identity formation. Indeed, it was a precursor to Facebook. It served as a platform for like-minded people to see and be seen, to create an imagined national community at once inclusive and exclusive. Like our own social media, It became a platform for those who even had to withhold their identities, presumably because they were surrounded by friends, family, neighbors, or co-workers who held opposing views. The Henri subscription allowed people, especially Protestants and Jews, to come out of their anti-Dreyfusard closets. In this manner of constructing what Lewis calls a counter-republic, the networking is similar to Wüst's efforts to create a French Republic identity based on rational morality, though in the case of the Henri subscription, readers communicated and built a collective identity with one another, and the messaging was much more multi-directional. My one question for Liz is the use of the term citizenship and counter-republic. I think that you should think more closely about that, and I'm not going to elaborate here perhaps during the discussion. I may be going out on a limb here, but the topic of psychology and my own reference to Le Bon prompts me to ask, did the Henri subscription as a medium build a Le Bon type of psychological crowd? As Le Bon stated, quote, the disappearance of conscious personalities and the turning of feelings and thoughts in a different direction, which are the primary characterizations of characteristics of a crowd about to become organized, do not always involve the simultaneous presence of a number of individuals on one spot. Thousands of isolated individuals may acquire at certain moments and under the influence of certain violent emotions, such, for example, as a great national event, the characteristics of a psychological crowd, unquote. The Dreyfus Affair was, of course, the great national event that emerged during a period of deep collective anxiety and around which opposing crowds, psychological and real, formed. The anti-Dreyfusard seems susceptible to the contagious suggestibility Le Bon describes as psychological crowds, while Baptiste Jacob, Emma Wüst, and Paul Desjardins exemplified all those who tenaciously held to the logic of evidence, rationality, and republicanism. In conclusion, these papers taken collectively resonate in our own time when a great and dangerous divide exists once again between those who have faith in empiricism and scientific evidence, not to mention social justice, and those who seem susceptible to a kind of social media-driven crowd psychology based on a shared intuitive mysticism. And I'll end there.
If it's okay with the panelists, I'd like to take questions from the audience in the time that's remaining, which is not a whole lot. So please, Eliza has the microphone. I'm going to let you take care of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My question is for Eric, and that is how to account for Jacob's accusation that Bergson was not only a mystic and impressionist, but in that 1897 article also a neo-materialist, as you might recall. Because it's difficult in that light to countenance his claim, Jacob's claim, that is, that Bergson is sweeping away science, certainly a certain philosophical science of the mind, associationism, but matter and memory, as you might recall, is very much engaged with experimental science, namely cerebral localization. And these accusations are being launched against Bergson, a Jew, who at the time of the publication of this article had already ascended from the ranks of a lycée professor up to the Collège de France. I mean, so this is quite an successful figure. He was a docent at the time. So I guess my question is then how to read Jacob as a window onto society and the Dreyfus Affair generally as anything more than one that illuminates the complete imbrication of science, metaphysics, and republicanism from the time, as opposed to rendering those categories more clear.
That's an excellent question. So what I would like to do is indeed exactly read Jacob as someone who can tell us more about the whole philosophical establishment and how they're thinking about things. Right, that's what I would like to do. Whether I succeed in doing that is another question. It seems to me that, first of all, about neo-materialism, he means pretty specifically ancient materialism, right? When he says, Jacob does. So it's not so much that, it's not that you're taking brain science too seriously, it's rather that you believe in, you're like a Heraclitian or something like that. So it's and my own background here is probably not adequate to explaining all of that, but it's not about you're taking brain science too seriously, right? There's a lot of argument about right, Spinoza, Leibniz, Hegel, like this tradition, right? And Jacob thinks that Bergson is breaking with all of that, right? He thinks he's rejecting all of that. I would not like to say that I agree necessarily with Jacob there. I do think that this article is a solicited piece, basically. What happens is Jacob is talking to people, he expresses how much he dislikes this, Celestin Boulet gives him the book and says, you should write this. Eli Alevi reads it. There's a nice letter where it's like, well, I know Boulet is too much my friend, and he will say nice things about it, but Alevi will tell me the truth if he thinks it's terrible. So I do take this as a kind of collective statement in some way of the RMM, that Bergson is eliminating something that's necessary for rational thought, which is a particular relationship between philosophy and science that they take very seriously. Does that sort of answer a little bit your question?
I think it sort of brackets the Dreyfus affair. But
it does bracket the Dreyfus. Well,
we can move on.
Okay. I think there was a question on this side, Carol?
Yes. My question is for Liz. This was a fascinating panel. So I actually have two questions, but I don't know if you'll have time for both. First of all, I find it kind of extraordinary that there were Jews who were part of the subscription, and I don't know if you have any more you can say about that. Like, you know, I don't know if you kind of had enough time to figure out what might be going on, but if you could speak to that. And then also, the fact that this kind of inversion of familial hierarchies on the subscription, I mean, what do you make of that? I guess I didn't need this, which I'm holding.
It's interesting. I am likewise fascinated, is one word, horrified is another word, by the presence of Jews in the subscription, which I honestly, you know, it's early enough, I'm still kind of collecting the data on it, that I can't say a whole lot about it, because it's something that clearly there is something. The problem there is, you know, it opens up the door to many, many, many more questions. Not just why on earth would anyone who's Jewish be reading and sending money to La Libra Powell, which is, for those of you who are maybe not as familiar with it, utterly and absolutely from the top of page one to the bottom of page four, anti-Semitic, including its sport and fashion columns. All of it. It's nothing but anti-Semitism. It's just that's what it is. That's something I'm kind of digging at. And I really do think it has to do somehow with this idea of the nation, not only as this ethnically defined thing, but also something where you have to keep continually participating and proving your part. As for the inversion of family hierarchies, that's another thing that's fascinating. You do see this again and again. You'll see these various lines that are all coming from the same family, and they jumble them around. They're, you know, the editors were indeed putting these things in order. So the fact that they are, in some cases, putting the wife first before the husband, putting the children before the parents, suggests that not so much that they're intentionally kind of overturning the hierarchical family, but that in some ways the hierarchical family doesn't matter as much as one would expect it to. So it's not so much that they're doing it intentionally, it's that they're not doing it unintentionally, I guess. They're not actually going through and saying, oh, we got to put that first. And that, I think, has to do with, there is, you know, and I've argued that there's a certain, though not entire, certain leveling effect in ethno-nationalism and ethno-antisemitism, where what blood you have in you starts to matter almost a little bit more than other characteristics, which is not to say, of course, that this is egalitarian. They're not at all. But I think that it is a artifact of that, where it's, you know, well, all the family subscribes, so we're going to put the family together, but it doesn't really matter what order.
Great questions. I think there's another session at the door, but I think I will allow for one more question. You've been really patient. Okay, go ahead. You need this.
More prosaic. All of this is occurring during the brewing of the Fashoda crisis. And I'm wondering if you find reactions to that reality, to external crisis and real threat versus internal crisis and real threat occurring at the same time, especially in the creation of a Libanian moment in France in 1898-1899.
So that is actually what my special issue of historical reflection, Reflexion studied, is about.
Great.
It's called War,
Great.
Occupation and Empire in France and Germany from 1870 to 1939, and it looks at those triangular relationships between arguments over internal enemies, arguments over European enemies, and arguments over colonial others, and my own pieces on the Union for Moral Action. And their paradoxical assumption that the German occupation of Alsace and Lorraine is clearly wrong, but the French occupation of Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, and part of Africa and Asia is clearly fine, as long as done responsibly, decently, and in civil order. So,
that's maybe why Jews can also take membership in these organizations. The human species has many variations. Jews giving money to the FN or voting for the FN quietly and more. We're talking about small numbers of people who do those things, but there are all kinds of permutations. The work on the German army in World War II now demonstrates that very, very well, that you had tens of thousands of whatever you call it, half Jews and quarter Jews in the German army during the war.
Thank you all very much.